Hey everyone, welcome back to the Dealing with Lifestyle podcast. My name is Fernando.
And I'm Randy.
And this is a podcast dedicated to the, we used to be the young professionals seeking their next things, but
yeah,
I think we're kind of changing our tone a little bit, right?
Yeah, we've talked about it before, I know, about diving into hot topics and, you know, places where people tend to disagree on things. And we decided that this seems as good a time as any to start braving the wilderness, and more or less. So we've decided we're going to start talking about those various hot topics. And today we're going to talk about diversity, inclusion, and equity programs in general. So Fernando and I have some disagreements on, what the utility is and what the potential dangers are of a program like that, if any. So we kind of talked about it last week. We were supposed to record, and then the batteries on the recorder got messed up. So we ended up chatting about this instead. And Fernando and I decided, like, hey, you know what? Let's put this on the podcast. We've talked about doing it. We've talked about, you know, having those hard conversations with friends. And we decided, you know what? People are probably going to hate us. People are probably going to try and cancel us. But, you know, we need to normalize being able to have difficult conversations with each other. Yeah. And we need to, show that we can have disagreements on things and still be good friends and care about each other at the end of the day.
Yeah, because I mean, the whole premise of the podcast is dealing with life stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, these are the type of things that we're dealing with every single day, you know, whether that be the, you know, the issues that we face individually, the faces that we face in our relationships, or just the struggles that we see in corporate America or our respective industries. But at the end of the day, they're issues that we're, you know, having to fight.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the word hot topic. Or the phrase hot topic. And I think even though this is like a hot topic in the world right now,
mm-hmm.
I think we're both, you know, very aware of what's really going on. And we're not talking about it just for the sake of, you know, trying to get views.
Right.
If you are new to the podcast, you know, we've been recording for about 2 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really excited to continue to bring you content. But, you know, to Randy's point, we really want to make sure we're talking about real things.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about tangible things. You know, we've had guests on the show in the past, and I think we want to continue to do so. And maybe just bring some subject matter experts
yep.
on some of the issues that That'd we're facing. Great. You know, so we're really excited to dive deep into this. This is going to be a different format. If you guys had a lens into what our current situation is here, Randy and I have both laptops in front of us, have books.
Yeah.
Randy's going to go through some notes that he has, and I have my notebook. But you know, I want to just paint the picture that this is going to be a little bit of a different conversation.
Yeah.
And there's going to be some pauses in here and there. But, you know, yeah. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, this is a real conversation. We haven't scripted this in any way. We've talked about it in the past, but never to a live platform, so to speak. So this is new for us, and you know, we're both nervous because we understand the culture right now wants to wage war sometimes, and I'm particularly a little nervous because I know I'm taking a position that a lot of people would deem as controversial, and you know, I understand that. I have positions in my public sphere, in my career, that might be a risk for me saying the things I'm going to say. But
ruin our futures.
Yeah, we're putting our futures at risk. You know, we talked about the Gad Saad article about putting skin in the game, and to me that really struck a chord. And when I read Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and I read his Nobel lecture interview or lecture afterwards, he talked about, like, hey, if you have a truth, you need to speak out. And you know, Fernando and I see the world differently, and that's okay. That's a good thing. We can talk about it, and we can find, you know, that middle ground, or more or less, or at least help see each other's perspectives. We're not here to change each other's mind. We're here to just understand where each person is coming from.
Because I want a world where you're in it, and
yeah.
I would hope you would want the same
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
I think, like, that is the value of this conversation, because, you know, this conversation isn't to say, well, how do I get rid of Randy, and same vice versa for you. It's more about how do we exist in a place where both of our needs are going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, we need to find a common ground to where, I'll say, the rules and the social construct of what we're designed to live with in mm-hmm. the parameters of living in America are going to be, and that we can both, you know, live a fruitful life. And I think that's at the end of the day, that's what we want, right? We want to be able
yeah.
to I don't have to edit that out if you guys don't blow your ears, where we're able to live that life.
Yeah, and I think that's a great jumping off point to kind of go into it, because that's where we can establish our commonality. Like, we can both agree that ultimately we want the best for every person, regardless of their upbringing or regardless of who they are. As long as they're a good person, we want the best for as many good people as we can get right. at the end of the day.
And I think, you know, Randy kind of shared it last time, we had intentions of recording a podcast episode last time we got together, which was, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, yeah.
And in that, you know, we took advantage of the fact that you came over and we just, you know, shot the shit and talked.
Yeah.
And this topic was one of the ones that we talked about. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one thing that was very beneficial for us, and maybe we'll do that here now again, is, you know, we dove into the whole diversity, inclusion, and equity, mm-hmm. DIE, right? Mm-hmm. We'll call it D&I for now. We'll just call it what it is. Yep. And I think it's important for us to define what we're going to talk about today, mm-hmm. so we can actually start the conversation,
yeah.
and then really understand, you know, what's the purpose of us even talking about this.
Yeah.
Like, why are you invested in what you're, you know, advocating for, and mm-hmm. then why am I interested in advocating for it?
Right.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, that's okay. A perfect way to describe it. And I'll also mention, you know, I'm personally studying Socratic logic right now just to understand how to really frame an argument and a perspective and make it as logically sound as possible. And, you know, the functions of that are having clear and unambiguous terms, having true premises, and having a logical conclusion. And when Fernando and I talked, it wasn't, you know, for me, I understand where my position is. So I wanted to just ask him questions. And I think that's a good way to go about it. I think we can establish the terms we're going to talk about and where we agree on those terms and have an agreed understanding of what those terms are. And then we can, I think we'll take turns giving what our argument is and then let the other explore that and just ask questions. I think that's the best way to go about it. Cool. So we'll start with definitions and terms. So let's talk. What do you define diversity, inclusion, and equity?
So we'll start with the word diversity.
Yeah, and I also think we should do each word individually and then the program as a whole. I think perfect. That's important to delineate.
I think diversity to me is, it's sometimes hard to define a word without using the word itself. Right. To me, diversity is the differences that people bring.
Okay, so I'm just going to run off Webster's Dictionary.
Sure.
I'm pulling this up right now. I should have had this prepared, but more examples that we don't have any of this ready. So the definition of diversity per Merriam-Webster, number one, is the condition of having or being composed of different elements. Yep. Or number two, an instance of being composed of differing elements or qualities. I think that's a pretty accurate definition from the dictionary, right? Yeah. Is that a fair one we can run
Yeah,
with?
I mean, I think it's in line with what I was saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think inclusion, I have the next one pulled up here. Or you know what, let's do this. You want to do one by one, or do you want to?
Okay, one by one.
So inclusion is the action or state of including or being included within a group of structure. Second definition is the practice or policy of providing equal access to opportunities and resources for people who might otherwise be excluded or marginalized, such as those who have physical or mental disabilities and members. I think that's besides the point of other minority groups. That's more of an example there. Mm-hmm. But I think that the definition is the action of state of including or being included within a group or structure.
Right on.
Yep. I think we can agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I'm sorry. Could you read it one more time for me?
The action or state of including or being included within a group or structure.
Okay. And equity I pulled up. Number one is justice according to natural law or right, specifically freedom from bias or favoritism. And B of number one is something that is equitable, which is existing or valid in equity as distinguished from law, or having or exhibiting equity, dealing fairly and equally with all concerned. And then there's a value of money definition saying, you know, money, value of a property or of an interest in a property in excess of claims or liens against it. And then there's a system of law originating in English chancery and comprising a settled and formal body of legal and procedural rules and doctrines that supplement, aid, or override common and statute law and are designed to protect rights and enforce duties fixed by substantive law.
That's a long definition.
Yeah, there's a lot there.
Yeah. The Oxford definition here says the quality of being fair and impartial.
Okay, yeah, I like that idea. Just the idea of being fair and impartial. Cool. So now let's dive into how do we define diversity, equity, and inclusion programs.
I think the purpose of diversity and inclusion.
Well, not the purpose. What are we? Okay.
The definition.
Mm.
Is that what you're saying? The definition of the program.
What are these programs?
These programs are. I'm going to answer it, and if you think I'm going on a different tangent here, we can do that.
Yeah.
They are programs. I want to go back to purpose, because that's the reason why, that's how I define it.
Okay, sure.
So I think the purpose of it is to help build. So we're talking about the diversity, inclusion, and equity program for an organization. The intent of that program is to help people from different places,
mm-hmm.
or different places, or individuals, or different perspectives, to mm-hmm. come together to feel as if they are part of it, and they're also able to take part of it with fairness and impartiality as to who or where they come from.
All right. I like that. And I will add that because of the inclusion factor, that they are actively being included into those programs.
Yes.
Okay. So I think we can totally agree on that definition. Yeah. So we'll get, so now we'll jump into where we differ. So for me, the forceful act of inclusion is where I have a problem, because I totally admit and understand that there are disparities in outcomes, and there are disparities within different organizations and careers, where, you know, different groups of various qualities, you could say race or gender, but I personally don't think either of those should be a factor in qualifying what someone's capabilities are. And for me, I have an issue with inclusion, because that forces an outcome to represent the ratio of differences between people based on arbitrary and subjective terms by an authority who's implementing that inclusion. So for me, that does that make sense?
I think so. I'm trying to follow that.
So
I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No,
but from what I understood, you're saying you have a problem with these programs, you have a problem with the programs like these because of, I wrote down the words that you said, a forceful act of inclusion. And I think the issue is someone's forcing you to be inclusive. And that's where you have the issue.
Well, not even.
At its core, I guess.
That's part of it. And okay. The second part is you're forcing the inclusion of others that are underrepresented within an organization. Because when you are forcing the inclusion of some person, it's at the detriment of another.
Forcing the inclusion of someone.
Yeah, forcing the inclusion of someone at the detriment of another based on arbitrary differences.
So we're going to do our best not to mention any organizations we're a part of.
Yes.
This is just, you know, subjective out in the world, but at the end of the day, we're going to rely on what we know and our experiences.
We're abstracting the concepts.
So I don't see programs forcing anything. So I'll use me for an example.
Mm-hmm.
The goal for me to be part of diversity, inclusion, and equity programs is to help the little kid version of me,
mm-hmm.
regardless of race, but
or
I think or origin or whatever.
Because we agree that those are irrelevant factors.
Well they're relevant, but for the sake of this, is
right.
The current part of this discussion, it's somewhat irrelevant.
Yeah.
Because the point is to allow, I don't want to go on a search on attention.
Yeah.
The point of the program is to let the smaller version of me see me and see themselves doing it, or see themselves being represented, so that they can think that they have an option and a potential opportunity to pursue a similar career path that I did.
Okay, so I want to ask you a few questions on that. So when you see, when you're talking about your younger self seeing the older version of yourself represented, what do you mean by that? Because I don't quite understand. Is that like...
So, like, for example, we look at movies, right? Mm-hmm. I look at a movie, and usually when you think of it... So, I mean, it's hard for me to ask certain questions sometimes because... Like, you're different than the average person, right? Because, and you also answer questions very different than the average person.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, if I were to ask someone, on average, hey, if there was a Hispanic role in a movie,
mm-hmm.
what would they be casted as?
Maybe comic relief or something.
In my view of the world, it's usually a janitor, mm-hmm. or a cleaning lady, or a gangster.
Mm-hmm.
It's like all these negative things.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm a little kid and I see the movies, in my mind, the only thing that I can be is a gangster,
mm.
is a janitor, is somebody who just brings in comic relief. I'm not the lawyer, I'm not the doctor, I'm not the engineer.
Okay.
So from that perspective, I'm being, and this is going on tangents, but I'm starting as a kid being conditioned to believe that that's my only route.
Okay. Let me.
And this is just the American thing, because in Mexico, like, the movies are what they are.
Sure.
And in, you know, a lot of America, they are what they are. So you will have representation.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about in the context of living in America.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to help us in this program conversation as well.
Okay. So let me ask you this. Do you feel that that perception might be influenced mainly on the main roles that are cast towards Hispanics as being, like, let's say, like a Fast and the Furious movie, maybe, I don't remember this exactly, so I'm probably going to get roasted, but let's say one of the Hispanic characters cast is a main character, but she's portrayed as a gangster or a violent person. Do you feel that there's a little bit of a bias there and not recognizing maybe there's a minor role where a Hispanic is cast as a doctor or a liar that, or not a liar, a lawyer that is just not as drawn into you because they're not a main character?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, I've seen it.
Sure.
There's actually a movie. There's a company. I don't want to go on tangents again. I'm going to keep saying that because I need to remind myself not to go on the side here. But there's a movie where everything is backwards. Like, it's an American-made movie. I think it's a Hispanic-owned company. And all of the cast is opposite. Like, the main characters are all Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And the janitor and everything else is, like, Caucasian individuals being casted.
Mm.
And, like, there was a huge uproar about that.
Mm.
Because, like, that's why they cast movies like that. That's different.
I would love that. That sounds hilarious.
So I'll send you the movie.
Yeah.
The movie. But, again, I think, what was I trying to go with this? The idea is, going back to the inclusion programs, you know, my goal isn't to say, hey, let's do a DIE program focus on taking away the opportunity for someone who is better suited for the board position than me because I'm Hispanic.
Okay.
It's more about I'm trying to be part of this program and I'm I'm capable as much as you are and potentially even more capable to do this role.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, I happen to be Hispanic.
Right. I think
that's part of the program.
So okay.
That's all it is.
Okay.
And when I'm there, I know I'm monopolizing the conversation right now, but
that's okay.
When I'm part of that program, the goal is if I'm sitting in a room that happens to be, there happens to be 20 people in there and I'm the only Hispanic person and everybody else has different opinions and I say certain things and people look down on that, like that's where the lack of inclusion comes in.
Okay.
Because people aren't willing to say it from my side. Because I'm just bringing in my new ideas rather than saying, well, Fernando brings his perspective. It just happened to be different than ours.
So do you feel that if you're in an instance where you're the only Hispanic in a room and your ideas are looked down upon, do you feel that is expressly because of discrimination or?
No, it's a reality of life.
Okay, but do you feel like that it's just a function, or could it be do we acknowledge that it could be something else other than race? It could be just, you know, an experience or.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with that.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think, sorry, go ahead. Continue.
That's one of the things I think we defer on is, to me, it feels like a lot of people will see an instance where there's one Hispanic in the room and they have a dissenting opinion and they're looked down upon and suddenly it becomes a race thing.
No, I don't think so. I mean,
right. Yeah. And we can agree on that.
Yeah.
To me, if like when I see it, I feel that, or it feels to me that a lot of people will immediately go to that route because it's an easy thing to do.
And I'm fearful of bringing up this example because it may be taken out of context, but I mean, this whole thing can be taken out of context. So I mean, whatever. To me, like there used to be racist laws.
Yes.
And to me, we're moving towards a place where we're removing, and if not, maybe removed. I'm not completely in line with I'm not well versed in the law, but I would imagine that for the most part, all racist laws are gone. However, there is a lot of racist agendas.
Mm.
And I think there's a difference between saying, well, you know, the structure of the law is racist. And I think if I come from that perspective, we're going to have an argument for hours just so we can both agree that maybe we're going to agree to disagree. Or we can say, you know what? There is no racist laws. Let's agree to that.
Okay.
However, there is a lot of individuals who have racist agendas who utilize the current construct of the law to push their agendas.
Mm.
And that's a whole different conversation altogether.
Yeah, we'll ignore that one because, yeah, I have too many questions to ask.
Yeah, that's separate. Yeah.
Another time.
But the reason I share that example is because to your earlier question about, you know, me being in that room with 19 other individuals who are not part of my demographic,
mm-hmm.
am I saying that that is because everybody else is racist and they're keeping me down and my mm-hmm. people down? Or am I going to say, this is the reality of it,
mm-hmm.
and how do we collectively work to where you give me an opportunity mm-hmm. to be able to not take someone else's role,
mm-hmm.
but build up my community so that they can become well-equipped enough to mm-hmm. belong to sit in this room
mm-hmm.
who happen to beat out someone else for their individual, you know, resume
right.
to take up another spot, and they happen to be Hispanic.
Right.
Right? Like, that's to me, that's different. And I'm not coming from a place of, well, everyone's racist. And
right. So I just want to make sure I'm understanding where you're coming from on that regard. You want to make sure that there are opportunities for everyone, regardless of race, if they come from, let's say, a lower socioeconomic background, because I think we can agree that we want all, you know, people from a lower socioeconomic background to prevail in higher income roles down the road. We want to give the opportunity and the knowledge to those underprivileged children in that regard, that they can make something of their lives.
Correct.
Okay, I agree with
regardless
that.
Regardless of race.
Regardless of race.
Right.
Regardless of anything.
I just... Yes.
I would say regardless of anything other than the content of their character.
Correct.
Yeah.
But the data shows that certain demographics need more help than others.
Okay, so that's just a great point, because I have a quote here from John Adams. I'm reading his biography right now, and this was just a really apt quote. This is from David McCullough, his biography, which I highly recommend. John Adams said, I'll just read from the passage. To Adams, nothing had changed about human nature since the time of the ancients. Inequities within human society were inevitable, no matter the political order. Human beings were capable of great good, but also great evil. Thus, it had always been, and thus it would ever be. He quoted Rousseau's description of, quote, that hideous sight, that human heart, end quote, and recounted that even Dr. Priestley had said that such were the weaknesses and folly of men, quote, their love of domination, selfishness, and depravity, end quote, that none could be elevated above others without risk of danger. How he wished it were not so, Adam wrote. Thucydides had said the source of all evils was, quote, a thirst for power from rapacious and ambitious passions, end quote, and Adams agreed, quote, religion, superstition, oaths, education, laws, all give way before passions, interest, and power, end quote. As to the ideal of a nation of equals, such was impossible, quote, was there, or will there ever be a nation of whose individuals were all equal in natural and acquired qualities, in virtues, talents, and riches? The answer in all mankind must be in the negative, end quote. Even in America, where there was, quote, a moral and political equality of rights and duties, end quote, there were nonetheless inequalities of wealth, education, family position, and such differences were true of all people in all times. There was inevitably a, quote, natural aristocracy among mankind, end quote, those people of virtue and ability who were, quote, the brightest ornaments and the glory, end quote, of a nation, and may always be made the greatest blessing of society, if it be judiciously managed in the Constitution, end quote. These were the people who had the capacity to acquire great wealth and make use of political power, and for all they contributed to society, they could thus become the most dangerous element in society, unless they and their interests were aligned to one branch of the legislature, the Senate, and given no executive power. So I brought up that quote because he talks about the inequalities that are bound to exist. They're just always a function of society. So I agree with you in that we should make an interest in the people that are underprivileged and come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. 100% agree with that. Where I am concerned is when we give authority to people who can make the decisions on who we help based on their own subjective terms.
Yeah, and I think I don't agree with that. And that's scary, right? Because mm-hmm. to me, like, it doesn't matter who the person is or what they look like or where they come from. Like, if they think they're more virtuous than others,
mm-hmm.
it becomes subjective. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, you know, from a logic perspective, like, logic is logic. Mm-hmm. And usually there is no there's no subjective interpretation to logic, because mm-hmm. it becomes more of a like a quantitative approach.
Right.
And I think when you start, you know, bringing in qualitative approaches, mm-hmm. it makes things, you know, a little bit more difficult to manage.
I think you went the other way around, like quantitative, right?
Well, when you bring in qualitative perspectives, it's more subjective, right? Because qualitative is logic.
Yeah, I'm following you. Go ahead. Yeah.
So when you're all about numbers, mm-hmm. Numbers are numbers. Like, numbers don't lie.
Right.
But when you start bringing in the subjective perspective to your point, mm-hmm. of, you know, when you start giving power to individuals, mm-hmm. that's where things get scary, because who are those people?
Right.
And who chose them?
Right.
And why is it that they are more virtuous than the other individuals who can bring their own perspective? Mm-hmm. I think from an individualistic perspective, there's power in empowering the individual. Mm-hmm. There is to me, like, there are certain things that need to be of a group think. Or a group, I'm trying to like not bring in certain terms that I know have associations to them, mm-hmm. as I'm talking. That's why I'm like, you know, studying on my words. Where am I going with this? I'll leave it at that.
Right.
I don't think there.
We become embrace the potential danger of mob rule whenever we to Adams's point, come slave to our passions. So let's say we do get riled up over a certain topic, and we start to, you know, become angry or upset or emotionally charged by it, and we start making decisions that may or may not be in our best interests. So the example I'm thinking of is the Athenians during the Peloponnesian War. So for a quick summary, Athens was at the height of its power. You know, Pericles was leading Athens, and it was a great nation, but they Sparta was not happy. Sparta is a very conquesting nation, and they attempted to invade Athens. Well, they laid siege to the countryside but couldn't breach the wall, so they burned all the farmland surrounding the walls of Athens. And Pericles said, screw them, we'll just get all of our needs from our ports and we'll be fine. Well, the problem with that was there was a plague that came through the ports and it wiped out most of the Athenian population. Well, then Sicily to the west was suddenly being attacked by the Spartans, and the Athenians were riled up because they were being harassed by the Spartans on the outside. They had just gotten, you know, so many people had died from the plague, and they were like, this is an opportunity for us to go embarrass the Spartans. Let's go do it. They sent like 10,000 Athenians over shore, and then the war didn't, they thought it'd be an easy win. The war wasn't progressing. They asked for more troops. And then months later, a random sailor shows up to Athens to get a haircut and talks about that all the Athenians were slaughtered because they didn't have a direction. They were all arguing for who could be in control, and they let their passions get the best of them. And then something like 10,000 to 20,000 Athenians died, all their soldiers. And suddenly they were at the whims of Sparta back in Athens, and the Spartans invaded, destroyed the Athenian walls. And that was pretty much the end of the Athens.
And that's the scary thing about history, right? History repeats itself. And I think if you're able to see, you know, the patterns of history, I don't have the knowledge that you have when it comes to history, but I know that there's a common thread that every nation falls eventually. Mm-hmm. And it's scary to think that, you know, what if our nation falls within our lifetime? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying like, hey, I'm going to scapegoat and let my kids figure it out.
Right.
But it's scary to think that that day may come. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the news and you look at the way we're fighting and arguing about certain things right now, like we're ripping each other apart. Mm-hmm. And we're becoming more and more divisive.
Yep.
And that's a scary thing when you mention this history, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if we're going to be so worried about everybody fighting about certain things, is our country going to fall apart right underneath us, mm-hmm. because we're worried about other things? But coming back to the diversity and inclusion perspective, you know, I think these programs are powerful because, like, there's two different things happening with these programs. One of them is, I'll use the terminology recruitment and retention, mm-hmm. right? One of them is about recruitment. How mm-hmm. do we bring in a more diverse population to our respective organization or industry or company to bring their perspectives, right? Mm. To bring their side. In order to help with our retention, to help our current individuals who happen to have their own perspectives to feel more included when they see people like themselves around each other.
Okay, yeah.
Does that kind of help? Or does that make sense?
It does. And I have a question as a follow-up to that. What if they don't want to?
What if they don't?
What if we're forcing people to do things that are outside of their nature for the sake of hitting a diversity quota?
So when you say they don't want to, do you mean the people who are part of the DIE programs or the people who are
I'm saying,
being interacted with from the program?
I'm saying people being targeted by those programs. So for instance, I'll point out STEM fields, for example. Okay. So I'll pull up another example from my book here. This is from Gad Saad's The Parasitic Mind. It talks about egalitarianism. Let me find my right note here.
Just to make sure, as you go through that really quick.
Yeah.
So for an example, I do a lot of STEM outreach, right?
Mm-hmm.
I go and talk to kids from different populations. I usually target, you know, elementary schools and middle schools who have issues with their students, like with testing scores, whatever the case is, who happen to be a certain demographic. My goal in doing that is to show them what it could be like if they become an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
When they tell me, hey, that's cool and all, but that sounds boring, then I'm like, okay, cool. Like, that's not for you then. But know that you can pursue a degree if you want to in a certain area that you want. My job as a diversity and inclusion ambassador for STEM advocacy is just to let the kid know you have an opportunity.
Right.
If you don't pursue it, that's your own shit.
Right. Okay. And that's fair. So I want to point out STEM fields because STEM right now, there's a big push towards getting more women in STEM fields that we can both acknowledge. So this is from Gad Saad's A Parasitic Mind. In building an airtight, nomological network of cumulative evidence, one should try to anticipate and address all counterarguments that detractors are likely to levy. Recall that social constructivists posit that men and women are socialized into arbitrary gender roles, with toy preferences serving as an early manifestation of such, quote, sexist learning. How might one wield a death blow to this nonsensical premise? Forgive Gad, he's a little satirical at times and a little hyperbolic. The answer lies with Sweden. The cross-cultural psychologist Gert Hofstede has ranked Sweden as the most feminine country with the greatest gender parity across 50 disparate nations. The Scandinavian oasis of progressive platitudes has been conducting what amounts to a longitudinal societal engineering experiment for the past several decades, wherein they have sought to create the perfect utopian gender-neutral society. Hence, if there ever was a perfect case study of whether more gender egalitarian nation yields non-sex-specific toy preferences, Sweden is that country. Well, data have a pesky way of trashing the utopian dreams of delusional ideologues. An expansive study of Swedish children's toy preferences found that children's sex-specific toy preferences are not as malleable as social constructivists would like you to believe. It turns out boys will be boys and girls will be girls. And what happened in that study was we found out women tended to gravitate more towards fields of nursing and people related things, and men tended to gravitate towards fields about things versus women gravitating towards fields about people. So in the STEM fields, there are a lot more men than women in STEM fields, which that kind of goes against what I interpret to be a big cultural narrative right now, is that it should be relatively 50-50, that each gender is accurately represented, even though we have data to suggest that in a general gender-neutral society like the Scandinavian countries, men will tend to gravitate towards other fields more so than women. And to me, that seems to be a truism across whatever diversity we want to talk about, in the sense of disparity in outcome does not equal discrimination as the cause.
Yeah, I had written down in my notes that Jordan Peterson talks about this all the time.